We have a lot of ground to cover this morning on an extremely important topic, so I want to get started on time. For members of the committee, we don't have a quorum yet, so we're not going to be able to approve the minutes. I just want to sort of outline today what we're doing. Our subject today is on methamphetamine health issues, and I think the health issues that we'll speak to range from the kind of things that happen in terms of cleanups and those kinds of things that the health department's involved. And then moving ultimately into treatment options that are emerging with various examples. And members, on your agenda, we have a list of people, and we have one additional that I'm going to do my very best to try to manage our time so that we can have an opportunity for a brief presentation from Carol Falkowski from Hazleton. So, and I know that I'm sure that everybody in our committee has heard about their organization and credibility, and particularly Ms. Falkowski has been a publisher in this field. So, with that, I would like to begin, first of all, with the Department of Health presentation. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Chairman Bradley and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Kino. I'm manager of the Environmental Surveillance and Assessment Section in the Minnesota Department of Health. And the methamphetamine program is one of several programs that I oversee. The MDH started receiving phone calls in 2000 from local public health agencies, first responders, building owners, child protection agencies, and others about the potential risks associated with the exposure to meth labs. The calls trickled in at first, and then we started to see an ever-increasing number of these requests for assistance and advice. At the time, we didn't really have anyone on staff with expertise in this area, but it didn't take long before one of our staff members named Deborah Durkin took an interest in finding out more about the drug and the home manufacturing of it. Her research and work in this area has led her to become one of the experts in the state on the issue. She travels across the state, which she's doing today, so she couldn't be with us today, providing meth awareness training. Some of you and your constituents may have heard her presentations as she has spoken in every county in the state except for about three counties. Last year alone, Deborah gave meth-related presentations to over 15,000 attendees. Our initial involvement in trying to help answer a few questions about meth lab health impacts only 4 years ago has resulted in an overwhelming demand by the many, many local and state agencies and the public in general for information about how a comprehensive and cooperative fight can be issued against this, for the battle against this epidemic. And today I'm just going to give you a very brief history of the meth activities we've been involved with and a glimpse at some of the health-related issues. I provided you with a more extensive handout. I'm not going to go through all of this, but there's a lot of good information, and this is kind of the basis of the presentation that the Department of Health does as we go out and talk with people about the problem. In 2001, Minnesota Multi-Agency Meth Task Force was formed. We realized that we needed a cooperative effort amongst many state agencies that are involved in trying to address this problem, and that included the Department of Public Safety, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Department of Human Services, Agriculture, and several local agencies as we tried to figure out how to struggle with addressing this very, very widespread problem. And we focused our efforts in areas of response in law enforcement, education, prevention and training, child protection, removal and remediation, and intervention and treatment. And to date, there are 40 meth lab local cleanup ordinances in place. 17 are in the process of being written, and there's another 24 that are in some stage of preparation. There's about 25 counties with child evaluation and treatment protocols. There's about 40 counties with a meth task force involving local public health agencies, law enforcement, child protection agencies. There are 10 to 12 cities and counties working on precursor ordinances. There's ongoing training of clan lab officers, and there's ongoing public and agency presentations. And so we're also working to help with technical assistance in the legislation that's been prepared. And there are state and private agencies exploring meth treatment methods. In 2004, Minnesota was chosen as the first state for the first national methamphetamine conference. And actually that was a bit of an honor, as they told us that the reason they chose Minnesota was for the comprehensive approach we're taking to addressing this problem and how the state and local agencies are working together to solve the problem. So it was a very good conference. MDH in particular has assisted counties with staff training and establishment of these ordinances and child protocols. We provide daily individual technical assistance. We have a very extensive MDH website where all of these ordinances are located and people can access them. So we assist citizens through individual assists and referrals on all meth issues. We get about 30 calls per week on that. The MDH and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension have provided most of the meth-related education available from state agencies. And as I mentioned before, in 2004, presented to over 15,000 individuals, and we've distributed about 8,000 pages of printed material per month. The MDH website receives about 7,500 visits a month from people interested in this issue and looking for advice and help. We provide information and presentation on state and national conferences. And some of the people in these audiences are first responders, law enforcement, public health staff, county attorney and judges, corrections, and health care providers. Our role will expand as we continue to assist local agencies in determinations related to interior cleanups of homes that have been used, homes and buildings that have been used to cook meth. A little bit about meth itself.
Before you go, could you help clarify more precisely what the role of the health department is in this meth issue?
Sure. Mr. Chair, yes, I'd be happy to do that. We, as I said, kind of got into this because of the number of phone calls that we received for advice. And as that expanded from what are some of the health risks associated with it, we provided kind of what we call somewhat of a coordinative role for other state agencies in helping to bring together the people that would help to do a comprehensive response as far as addressing all of the issues. We really talk with local public health and counties about how to set up, how to get public health, law enforcement, child protection working together to establish an ordinance where it specifically addresses clam labs and the cleanups of them and the child evaluation protocols for once kids are removed from a meth lab, give advice as to what kind of remediation needs to occur inside the building, the washing of the walls, the removal of the carpet, taking the drapes out, to get the homes back to a condition where people are able to move back into them. So we've really kind of played somewhat of a glue of putting together the different agencies that need to work on this and help to have a coordinative role in that.
Well, just to make sure that I've understood, I can understand sort of on the cook sites and the cleanups and all the horrendous and terrible health risks and the families and all that kind of thing. So that sounds like that's primary. You're not as an agency into the other end of it. Because one could argue that there's health effects, of course, with people that are users, but that's true of some other drugs, although I think this one's even unique in that respect. But the health department is not so much involved in the treatment side, the effect on that end. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. That's Department of Human Services and other agencies that work with treatment.
Excellent. I just want to be sure that I understood it right.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Meth addictions and disability are uncommonly rapid, and that's what kind of makes this drug different than some other drugs. And we are concerned about all drug addiction, but this has an unusual rapid addiction. There's a growing group of practical or functional users that are using it. A lot of young women are using it for weight loss. And the meth is a drug of sexual enhancement. There's a lot of people that are using it for that purpose. Meth is inexpensive to buy and easy to make. You can get many of the products used to make meth at your hardware store, and of course the main ingredient, the precursor drug, is pseudoephedrine, which you can get in any drugstore at this time. Many young users are harmed and take this at a young age and are harmed at in early developmental stages. Meth travels in friendships and family circles. It's cooked amongst friends, and then agencies report second and third generation meth making and using families. Meth is used heavily with alcohol and other drugs. And children living with meth users are at high risk for sexual exploitation, sexually transmitted disease, HIV, and hepatitis. Meth use among women and girls equals or exceeds use by males, which is also different than some other drugs. We find it much more common in women and females than other drugs are. Meth labs add a dangerous and costly extra risk. As the meth is cooked in the homes, very many of these homes, 30 to 40% of them blow up because of the toxic chemicals that are used in the manufacture of it, providing yet another risk along with the drug itself. Meth users, the health effects, some of the health effects in users in the short term, some effects are dilated pupils, light sensitivity, euphoria and a rush, increased attention, decreased fatigue, some of the reasons that people take these drugs, and increased activity, decreased appetite, increased respiration, and increased blood pressure. Long-term addiction is related to amphetamines with a central nervous system stimulant, paranoia lasting months after use, hallucinations, mood disturbances, repetitive motor activity, rages, and violent behavior. There's also been some brain damage that's been seen in long-term users. They've done some brain scans, which have basically shown that they are symptoms that are similar to Parkinson's disease in some long-time users, changes in memory loss, prolonged depression, stroke, severe weight loss, inflammation of the heart lining, and damage to blood vessels. And I'm sure many of you have seen the articles recently about prisoners and the tooth decay. That is one of the signs of long-term meth use, is bone loss and tooth decay. It's also damage to the liver, kidneys, and respiratory system. The harm to children is one that is also significant. Children are present in 30 to 50% of these labs. There's an increase of incidence of complications with meth use during pregnancy, poor prenatal care and nutrition, ruptured placentas, breech deliveries, the babies can have low birth weight, drug withdrawal, and developmental disabilities. For children living in these environments, there's abuse and neglect in the increased risk for many risks of damage in the home, poor nutrition, health care, hygiene, chaotic sleep and life patterns, and their exposure to violent acts and events, and exposure to pornography and sexual abuse. Law enforcement tells us that in almost every one of these cases they find pornographic material. Some of the chemical hazards that are related to the cooking of meth are the numerous toxic chemicals that are used: toluene, anhydrous ammonia, metals, solvents, and bases. It's a toxic soup that's used to cook meth, and these hazards are, kids are being exposed to these whenever the meth is being cooked. Secondhand smoke is also a risk, along with the risk of fire and explosion. There's also physical and biological hazards present at these meth labs. There's weapons, explosives, booby traps. These individuals are extremely paranoid and think that law enforcement is watching them on a regular basis. Filth, feces, rodents, pests, dirty needles, many of these are start out as what would be considered garbage homes. Exposure to sexually transmitted and bloodborne diseases. There's inadequate heat, electrical plumbing, and vicious animals. The agency staff who go in and try to address these houses are also at risk for many of these same exposures. And there are much more harm that's done to children when they live in former labs and do not receive the appropriate care. I've heard many, many stories about how parents, when they're on these drugs, the drug is what they want, and to the exclusion of care about for themselves and for their children. Every day we hear from professionals who are working in the field, or from relatives, friends, neighbors, school teachers, of someone who has been impacted by this drug. You hear about it every day. It seems like every week you read another article or there's a special on TV about the meth epidemic. They say it's one of the most devastating and highly addictive drugs they've ever seen. During Tuesday's Senate hearing, we heard from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, a sheriff, a physician, a public defender, rural and urban county attorneys, district court judges, recovering meth addicts, and the state attorney general about the need to restrict access to the precursor drug pseudoephedrine, which is the essential ingredient for manufacturing meth. We heard about the millions of dollars it is costing local units of government and taxpayers to address the myriad of problems this drug has caused. Many of those people who will testify today have spent untold hours trying to curtail this problem, and I've personally witnessed and experienced the frustration and exhaustion of what has been a mountainous battle to try and deal with the meth problem. So at that point, I'd like to take any questions that you have.
Ms. Mayor, just a couple of things. I mean, your presentation, I went through the materials here in addition. There's a lot of great material in here, and oh, it's tempting to spend a lot of time. We're not going to be able to spend too much, but just at least a couple of things. One, in terms of the cleanup, are the sciences, the processes and so forth pretty well established so we know how to sort of contain and actually clean up so that it's a clean site after? Where are we at in that regard?
Representative Bradley, we have been working very closely with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and in the last year, they have done fairly extensive research into the efficacy of different processes and procedures for cleaning up the interiors of these homes. When we initially started this back in 2000, we went to websites for other states looking at what kind of cleanup requirements they had established. And they had, for the most part, Washington and Oregon, we looked to them because they've had this problem on the West Coast much longer than we have. And we basically adopted what they had at the time, which is a numerical standard for cleanup. As the research has continued on this nationwide, I think what is being determined is very difficult to come up with a numerical standard to clean interiors of homes. And the PCA has done terrific research on this, and hopefully someone is here today to address what they've been doing. But they're looking at more of a process-based approach at this point. And the process-based approach would be to remove porous materials from the home, such as carpets, drapes, furniture, to scrub the walls, and to work at significantly reducing the levels of methamphetamine in the home. And by that process, we are assured that the houses are being, we are cleaning the houses and getting to them to a safer level. And that is where the state of the science is right now. We would hope that the federal government would take on the effort of doing much more extensive research into this, but at this time there is not a good numerical standard, and feel that the process-based approach is the best way to go at this point.
You know, let me just sort of, if I can play back a little bit, what I read out of that is, although we have some pretty well established, when it's all said and done, I don't know if we can really say that we don't that we still don't have some health risks for the sites. And you know, and the scary part from a kind of an exposure to health problem is that if we don't know how we make it 100%, and these things are popping up all over the place, we have sort of a crawling, creeping, nasty health risk to us, notwithstanding the taking of the drugs. But just all of those sites that still exist that might still have some hazard in terms of health, is that a reason for us to be a little concerned about that dimension?
Representative Bradley and members of the committee, you're correct in saying that there will not be a point at this point where we could say that the house is 100% safe. I'm not really sure that that could be said in many homes, quite frankly, with the risks of indoor air, mold, radon, and all the issues that we hear about. And the other, and like I had mentioned earlier, many of these were in the beginning what would be considered probably garbage homes. The process of cleaning, once they've been a meth lab, is actually going to address several of those problems in addition, because of the reduction of those hazards. Unfortunately, we don't live in a safe environment, and there will still be some risks, but we are hoping that these will mitigate many of the most significant risks.
I think that's commendable. The other one I'd wonder about, kind of an ongoing, is the protection of the law enforcement, health department, people that are actually doing these kinds of things, and where do you feel we are there in terms of protection of those people are actually doing cleanup?
Representative Bradley and members of the committee, yes, that is definitely a concern, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has a person who is Douglas County Park, who goes out and trains on a regular basis the law enforcement officers and talks specifically about those hazards. We talk about them when we do our presentations. There are definitely protocols that are in place that need to be followed with safety equipment, and the awareness level is out there. Whether or not the resources are always there to protect them is another issue, in both the local level and state level. And I think if you talked with some of our fellow officers, they would say that there's a lot of makeshift things that they have to do in order to protect themselves, because the resources aren't there. And one of our goals with all of the training that we do is to try and provide that training to any individual that may be in these types of situations, and to be aware of what those hazards are. And that would be a goal that we have strive for and continue to work on.
Well, thank you. Again, it's a good framework. We do have one question, and I'm responsible as much as any people are asking things, but this is a really important stuff. But Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in the line of cleanup also. And I've been to many forums, and I've heard many different stories of contamination. And as a member of the health department, I'm going to ask for some clarification on some. They say the clothing in the house is contaminated by the uses of the fumes and et cetera. And then I've heard stories where even when the children wear them to school and they hang next to another child, that can contaminate the next child's coats. And in the refrigerator, any meth can contaminate all the food in the refrigerator. And I've heard this from other health departments at the county level. That's my first question. How serious is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, when we talk with local units of government and agencies that address this, one of the things we stress is that when it comes to cleaning up meth labs in homes, there needs to be a very close efforts with local public health agencies, law enforcement, and the owners of the building and the contractor that's cleaning up the house. And depending on where the mess has been cooked, it is possible and likely that many of the clothes and carpeting, drapes, and all that have been contaminated. And there's testing that can be done to determine where the contamination lies. And in some cases, yes, many of those things will have to be disposed of so that there is not a continuing exposure. Every meth site is different. Some are cooked in garages, some just are just smoking in the homes, some are manufacturing in the homes. In the areas where the manufacturing is being done, you're going to definitely have your highest level of exposure. And working with cleanup contractors, and they're going to have to do a fairly extensive look at the area to see what needs to be removed and thrown away.
My second question, and it deals with right now, if someone does a meth lab on your property, even though you have no knowledge of it, that we as owners are required to clean up that meth lab. That's a big concern for those of us in rural areas who own acres of farmland and now are responsible to clean up a lab that we didn't even know and we weren't the users. Can you tell me where that is and how we can resolve some of that? Or maybe that's MPCA's place, but it's definitely an issue out there.
Ms. Kino?
Mr. Chair, Representative Otremba, when one person uses a property for meth manufacturing, is going to be, a lot of times, a person is either incarcerated or thrown in jail and not able to clean up the property. If someone has this property where they're not knowing that there's meth cooking going on, it is going to the local units of government, if they have passed a local meth ordinance to clean up the facility, we'll be looking to the individual who owns the property to help clean the property up. Now, there's been several pieces of legislation that have been introduced that include a revolving loan fund to assist counties and individuals who are in those types of situations to help pay for the cleanup of the facilities. And I think that personally would be a very good way to address some of the situations where people are unknowingly in those situations or unable to afford the cleanup.
Well, Mr. Chair and
Ms. Senator Tremba, I really want to move on.
But it's a loan. And to make the landowner who has no ties to that meth pay for it leaves a lot of us very vulnerable, because then they will always be using somebody else's land in the backwoods so that they're not responsible. So just that's a...
Yeah, Representative Crummer, I think that's a fair issue. And if there are bills coming around, I think since there is a health dimension to this, we ought to see those bills as well. So we'll probably revisit that. Representative Goodman, one final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I assume that there's homes that people have no idea that they buy a home that where meth was used or made or whatever. How easy is it to do testing to find out if there's meth residue in a home? Is that possible?
Ms. Kino?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there are tests that can be done fairly easily to test whether the wipe samples that are done in the homes to test whether or not it has been used at a meth lab. And yes, it is a concern for purchasers of a home, and it is part of the disclosure requirements. But then again, these aren't always the most honest people and disclosing that type of information. So there are tests available. There are companies out there who do that type of testing so that you can find out whether or not it has been used.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Kino, fascinating presentation. I'm sure we could spend probably a couple of hours on this side of it, but this probably isn't the end of looking at the health issues, and perhaps some of those bills will come to us as well. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Sanderson, I'm sure because you were chairing the committee, you carefully reviewed the minutes and are prepared to move the Wednesday, February 16th minutes.
So moved.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We'll move now into sort of the next phase, and I know that we are going to really be rushed on a topic that could probably spend many, many hours because there's plenty of expertise around. We'll do our best to keep it moving. I would ask the testifiers to help us in that regard, and I will do my best as a chair to move it as well. But I think a logical start point for us would be the Department of Human Services. I mean, this is where we're making investments. This is where some of the, at least a good share of the money flows through various options. So let's bring forward, I have Jeff Hunsberger, but I think there's maybe a couple of additional people joining you. No. Okay. I guess not. Hunsberger, yes. Yes, please come forward. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Jeffrey Hunsberger. I'm a planner in the Chemical Health Division at Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Aware of your time constraints, I will try to move through.
Appreciate it. I know there's, but we do have some programs as well that we'd like to have a chance for them to discuss with us too. So
yes, thank you.
Please proceed.
I'll present information about the chemical dependency treatment for Minnesotans who use methamphetamine. Apologize for the way this is coming to you. Our packet was incomplete. We didn't get our financial data until just minutes ago. Our network was down and wasn't available until just minutes ago.
But Mr. Hunsberg, is it in our packet now, though?
It is now a single sheet that's coming with your packet,
okay.
Yes.
All right, you can acquaint us with what's in here then.
Yes. I'm going to skip over the topic of the terrible consequences of methamphetamine abuse. You just heard quite well described how that costs people and the ecology and a pocketbook. Currently, I'm going to give a picture of methamphetamine in Minnesota, a description of a typical CD treatment client with methamphetamine as their primary drug of abuse. But briefly, I will try to describe the public pay system that we have here in Minnesota. It will oversimplify the operation of this network of state and county and independent providers that we have to make up the chemical dependency treatment system, but I think it's appropriate for today's discussion. The state operates a Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, the CCDTF, which makes payments for treatment that are authorized by counties. The counties have rate-setting contracts with providers. They assess the clients, decide whether they're eligible for funding and whether they are in need of chemical dependency treatment. And the counties decide to which program and at what level of service the client will be served. Okay? Providers receive payment from the Consolidated Fund with the county's authorization. The county pays a share of that cost, about 15% in most cases. The system's been in place since the 80s. It was designed to help indigent, chemically dependent Minnesotans to quickly get the treatment that they need. Minnesota has a long record of treating the illness of addiction and currently has more than 300 licensed providers of CD treatment.
Excuse me, Mr. Hunsberger, just for clarification, that distribution of the county, is that formula-based, grant-based, or what? Or how does that work?
It's a very complex formula. I'm not prepared to describe
it. But it is formula-based?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I need.
Yes, Mr. Hanskin.
Thank you.
Information from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Information that was recently released showed percentages of each state's population in treatment, and I was surprised to see that Minnesota was in the lowest quartile of states in terms of population percentage receiving treatment in our state. The data I'm going to present next is from your packet. If you see something labeled methamphetamine users in Minnesota licensed treatment programs, it is a page like this, Mr. Chair. is not included in your packet, I can see.
I will. Is it a cover sheet?
It was an attempt to lighten the note-taking load of anybody who wants this data. And I will, these data, I will
we have it.
Provide them to the county. Or to, excuse me, to the committee. Methamphetamine was the primary substance of abuse in 2% of all admissions to treatment in 1996.
Excuse me, Mr. Hunsberger. If you have a copy that we could have our page copy it and then get them to the members while we're continuing.
Yes, please. That would be great.
Good opportunity.
I'm afraid I brought only the copy that I can refer from.
Oh, all right. Well, then we'll wait.
I will finish this and then
you can get it. We'll get the copy. Okay, thank you.
In 1996, methamphetamine admissions to treatment represented 2% of the whole. In 2004, it represented about 13% of the whole. The increase was accompanied by a corresponding decrease in the percentage of admissions for which alcohol was the primary substance. We do ask all of our licensed, or all of our providers who receive money from the Consolidated Treatment Fund to submit data on every admission that they receive. And in addition to demographic data, we also can get information, we also do get information about their chemicals of abuse, primary, secondary, and tertiary, so that we get, we're able to construct a picture of who we're serving with the dollars. Methamphetamine was the primary substance of abuse for 12% of our publicly funded clients in 2003 and 16% of publicly funded clients in 2004. So an apparent increase in our publicly funded client population of methamphetamine users in the amount of 4%. Only 46% of publicly funded clients were admitted for alcohol disorders use a secondary substance. That is, 46% of people whose primary drug of abuse is alcohol say they use any illicit drugs in addition. 76% of those admitted for methamphetamine disorders use a secondary drug. And that 76% is typical for users of illicit drugs. They're much more likely than users of alcohol to also use other drugs. Among the publicly funded clients who are admitted with a secondary substance of abuse, the most typical substances that accompany methamphetamine are marijuana and alcohol. About 55% use marijuana. About 27% also say they use alcohol. Methamphetamine was a secondary substance for only 5% of publicly funded clients who are admitted for other substances. So the prevalence of the secondary drug is similar to the prevalence of cocaine or crack among primary users of other drugs, meaning that if you are a meth user or a cocaine user, that is likely to be or become your primary substance of abuse. 58% of publicly funded clients in treatment for methamphetamine addiction completed their treatment. This is about 10% lower than the percentage completing treatment for alcohol disorders, but it is similar to the completion rate for other illegal drugs. The completion rate of those who use methamphetamine is virtually identical to the percentage of completion for those who use methamphetamine as well as other substances. So people who are strictly, that 24% that are strictly methamphetamine addicts and nothing else, don't seem to complete treatment at any different rate than the polydrug users who are methamphetamine addicts.
Excuse me, Mr. Hunsberger. In that question, then, that's a measure of success, completion of program, but not necessarily, in at least my personal opinion, a measure of really having made a cure. So I can use that kind of term or something, because I mean, people can complete, but 6 months later, a year later, I mean, those are the really key is, do we have a program? Do we do anything in terms of our investment in measuring sort of the longer-term effectiveness of the programs we fund?
Mr. Chair, we did, I believe in the mid-90s, last do a longitudinal study of outcomes. But we have found, I've been assured by our experts in our performance measurement and quality improvement section of DHS, that completion is a pretty solid proxy for the other things that we're looking for, the other outcomes that we're hoping to see post-treatment. That is, increase in stability of family and job, a decrease in illegal activity, other antisocial behavior. Certainly, it would be good to have the extended longitudinal picture, but that sort of study is quite expensive, and we haven't devoted the money again to do that.
I have Representative Trumba and Representative Wilkin. Your questions to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Trumba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is the length of treatment. Is it what is the length of treatment for meth in comparison to crack or alcohol or?
Mr. Hunsberger?
Mr. Chair, Representative, is your question that what is an optimal length of stay for methamphetamine addiction treatment, or what is typical?
Mr. Chair, I want
Trumba.
Typical because I know what the optimum is. I just want to know what.
Mr. Hunsberger?
Mr. Chair, Representative Trumba, we don't see treatment. I can't give you an average from the top of my head, but we don't see treatment lengths of stay far in excess of others. In the case of methamphetamine lengths of stays are similar to lengths of stays for other illicit drugs in like programs. One of the things that controls the lengths of stay in a treatment program is the agreement that a program will have with its host county. And once that's set, it's sometimes difficult to modify the services being provided by that program. I hope that's...
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair, is that 30 days then, or is it 18 months, or is it...
Mr. Hoover?
An average.
For an inpatient
average.
Stay, it's more like 21 days, 28 days. For an outpatient stay, it can range anywhere from 6 weeks to 2.5 months.
Mr. Hunsberger, in that regard, let's say the 21-day inpatient, and what it's a public pay, what are we typically paying on a public pay?
I'm afraid I don't have the average, and I would be, Mr. Chairman, I would be guessing, I'm afraid.
Hunsberger, if we could follow up with that, I'd like to get specific data on what our costs are.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will.
Senator Trumba, did you have a follow-up? I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I've read is 18 to 24 months are the optimal time for it to not repeat the usage of meth. So I just was curious of what these, because when you look at this, the completers, I think Representative Bradley has a great question when he asks, are they repeating?
It's a fear that I have, and whether or not it is a good proxy, I can tell you I hear different opinions, Representative Trumba, and you probably do too.
I do. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Wilkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hunsberger, you had mentioned that completion of the program was the best proxy for success. Seems like, I don't know how you can track that, and I'd be interested to see the data on that to show that just completing a program means success. From what I've seen, there's a lot of people who repeat, and they go in through one program to another program to another program. And do you track that at all when you're intaking an individual? And if so, are you finding out what previous programs they've been in so you can see where money has been used ineffectively?
Mm-hmm.
in which programs have a high recidivism rate. Do you have any kind of tracking mechanism for that? It seems like that would be much cheaper than longevity studies, which I don't know if we can expect you to do.
So, if I understand what you'd be suggesting is when a person enters, that you'd be looking back to see whether they had had previous treatments.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Hansford?
Mr. Chair, Representative. We have a method that will allow us now, we have a method that will allow us to follow individual clients across systems. We don't have a procedure now to identify their previous costs or the previous treatment treatments received, and provide it to the treatment program in which they find themselves. Now, we certainly can do that. As long as we can manage it within the constraints of privacy, and the requirements for privacy of information, data privacy is even greater in substance abuse treatment than in other medical care. We are serving people who have a chronic condition, a recurring illness, and so what we expect to see is a certain amount of repeated need, a certain amount of relapse.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up with Representative Wilkins' line of questioning, are we doing anything as it relates to evaluating the programs themselves? 21 days, 28 days isn't even enough for crack. And so you're going to be able to get into the repetitive drug treatments, as Representative Wilkin is referring to. Are we keeping track of not just the programs themselves? 28 days to get off of crack is going to take a very special individual to be able to do. So we're going to keep having them enter in until that miracle treatment or that miracle time happens. And now we're talking about meth, which ends up having more complications involved as a drug. Is it the program or is it the systems that are allowing us to only be able to truly fund having the counties do a 28-day program and having certain programs be able to private fundraise to deal with the gaps? And we're going to hear about some of them in a minute.
Mr. Hansberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, our representative. There were a few questions embedded in your question. We are, as the Department of Human Services, as part of our responsibility, training treatment providers in science-based, demonstrated as effective treatment methods for methamphetamine. Last year we trained 300 treatment professionals. This year we plan to treat the same number. We are doing that in order to bring the field along so that programs and individual treatment professionals can approach the counseling of people who are meth addicted much more effectively, design their programs so that they're much more effective. There is nothing in statute or rule that would prohibit a treatment stay of any length.
Mr. Chair, just real quick.
Representative Walker?
Thank you. I guess I too am interested in some of the stuff that Representative Wilkin is asking for. I don't know if the department currently has it or if we need to start tracking some of this. In order for me, you know, some of the research out there says to develop a habit or kill a habit, it takes 21 days. So if I need to start working out, for me to start wanting to do it, it's going to take me 21 days again to get back into the habit of doing things. And so we're talking about serious drug addictions and going back into communities that you're used to being at. And for us not knowing for sure if it's the program, it's the amount of stay, is it the funding, there's pieces here that are missing, and we have an epidemic going on, and we're trying to figure out as a legislative body how to deal with this damages to many of our communities without having all the information.
I think that was a statement. It didn't require a... Yeah, thank you. Representative Tremon, I know we have some really important testimony to get to as well, and I've got a ton more myself I'd love to ask, but maybe we can begin to wrap it up.
And this is one of the pages, and it's not numbered, but it's a public clients admitted and discharged. And it tells us how many clients were discharged, but the little note on the bottom says, a client who was admitted and discharged more than once is only counted once. And then there's a percentage of readmitted. So are those numbers someplace that we can see those and actually know how many times they're repeating, or are they all repeating, or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Trumbo. The reason we, or our data people sliced the data this way was to get a picture of recidivism, and we had to define it in some fashion. And the footnote acknowledged that there are some that may have repeated within the same year or may not have started during 2003 and hence weren't counted. I believe that the idea was that those who were not counted would be similar to those who were, and so it just narrowed the universe of those being studied. Yes, we can identify how many clients appear more than once in a year or in a half year. We're able to do that, certainly.
Mr. Hunsberg, I sort of sensed an interest in this committee, and maybe we can do a little bit of follow-up and get some of that. I know that none of those are ideal measures, but within a reasonable approach about literally following people and so forth, it looks like you do have some sort of a hint here about repeat. I don't think that anybody here is necessarily saying that repeat means complete failure, because there are going to be some repeat. That's normal. But as a measure, at least, I mean, if it were 100% of people repeating, we might all say, wait a minute, are we spending very wisely? If it's 20%, I think that's sort of where we're drifting to here, is help us better understand measures more than, and, you know, you probably sensed, at least I have, and I sensed a little bit of skepticism in the committee on whether the proxy of completing a program is really a good enough proxy.
Yeah,
I see a lot of heads going this way, so maybe we can follow up and get some data on that and help us out.
Yeah, thank you.
But then, well, I guess that completes. If you just quickly, if you don't have the numbers here, you talked about the process of where the money flows. You didn't talk about sort of the amount, and I would also probably assert that what we spend for chemical dependency, and specifically meth, would also include benefits under medical assistance, Minnesota Care, GOMC, those kinds of things. Off the top of your head, can you give me an idea of how much in total we spend in public dollars in meth and in drugs? Or if we don't have that, then we could follow up.
I will certainly get that information to you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'd like that if you don't mind, please. That'd be great.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Hunsberger,
there are some additional pages here that may be self-explanatory, but I would like to bring a couple to your
attention.
I can do that.
Appreciate it.
One is the single page labeled percentage distribution of secondary substance abuse by primary substance of abuse. It's a terribly long title, I'm sorry, but it is a table that looks like this. What it shows, and isn't immediately clear, in percentages are the secondary substances of abuse for people whose primary substances are listed in the left column. Primary substance of methamphetamine, those folks, as I said earlier, are more likely to abuse or also use marijuana, and then alcohol. If you look at alcohol users, they are also most likely to use marijuana than any other illicit drug. And the shaded sections are the top score in any of those, so it makes it simpler to see. I know we'd received a question specifically about this point. And then the final... I needn't go over, excuse me.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I have another better question. But
and then the final section of the packet are the demographic pieces that talk about substance of abuse in treatment by gender, so that you can see the percentage of all men who come in for cocaine or crack who come in for alcohol, who come in for methamphetamine, and the same for females. You can see on that table that the female percentage is significantly higher. Women are much more likely, if they're in treatment, to be in treatment for methamphetamine abuse than are men likely to be in treatment for methamphetamine abuse. On the back of that page are the breakouts by drug, by race or ethnicity. And I don't need to go through that, but you may find that interesting. And finally, in that section, the percentage distribution of primary substance by region, you can see that as a table. And below is the regional map of Minnesota showing the highest regions for methamphetamine, which also may be of interest to you. Thanks.
Ms. Renberg, just one sort of final on a different topic. On the subject of treatment programs, I know that, as I can remember in the past, when we looked at other sort of drug treatments, particularly chemical, that we found a little difference in effectiveness between inpatient versus outpatient, but of course outpatient was a lot less expensive. So some of us were inclined to think that, you know, maybe that's a direction. My hunch is that meth would probably not necessarily match that picture, and that is that from the profiles that I've heard is that you almost have to have some sort of inpatient. I guess I would just sort of ask, do we have a handle on inpatient versus outpatient effectiveness for meth treatment?
Stronger? I think we have half a handle. What we see in the data are the programs such as the Matrix Institute of California, which has been studied as much as any methamphetamine treatment model and found to be effective, is done entirely on an outpatient basis. That program is extended in length and is able, at least in that setting, with the clients that they admit, to treat them on an outpatient basis. I wouldn't suggest that any client with any particular substance of abuse could necessarily be treated on an outpatient basis. Some must go inpatient, I believe, but clearly even methamphetamine addicts can manage to complete a treatment program.
Ms. Johnsbury, if you could follow up, I think that is in your budget page. There's a referral to that. If you have something that would show, I'm trying to go here. I don't know whether we're comparing that to a 21-day inpatient or longer or whatever. Maybe just follow up and give me the data on how that effectiveness was measured and that California program that you were just talking about.
Yes, we'll do.
All right, thank you. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee. Next, I'd like to call forward Rich Schreiber, Teens Challenge, and I think, Mr. Schreiber, you may have some additional people with you. We can have new chairs that might be needed by Paige. We'll proceed. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you
Thank
testify.
You, Chairman. My name is Rich Schreiber. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Teen Challenge. I've got a couple of our residents. We're going to start with them and just have a short one-minute little synopsis of their story. This is Sarah. She'll be sharing first, and then Adam. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's an honor and privilege to be here. You've been hearing about meth.
Excuse me, Sarah. Sorry, it's up to you, I mean, if you are concerned about it, but if you can, we introduce ourselves so that our record is complete. If you're not comfortable with that, that's fine too, but whatever works for you.
I'm Sarah Peterson.
Thank you.
I'm a graduate of Minnesota Teen Challenge. You've been hearing about meth. I lived through meth. When I was first introduced to meth, it was instant happiness, and I had no idea what a trap it was. For 7 years, I was a severe addict. I could relate to everything that was been said about the paranoia. In and out of treatment centers, I was a hopeless case. I was in 7 secular treatment programs. I never made it clean, never remained clean. In 2002, I overdosed on meth and cocaine mixture, shooting up cocaine. I had a heart attack. I was placed in a treatment program mandatorily, and you'd think that that would, having a heart attack and being in critical care unit for 4 days would slow me down. I immediately went back to the drug, shooting up meth again. I would be in houses where they're mixing battery acid, muriatic acid, watching them pour ether and things into them, and then drawing it up in a syringe and shooting it into my vein. I hate meth. I hate what it does to people and families. I hate it. But there is hope. There is hope. I've been clean now for 3 years. 3 years. I'm ashamed of my past, but I know that I have a future. When I came into Teen Challenge, I was on death's door. I was a walking zombie. My life on meth consisted of being shut up in a house, peering out the windows. I was a paranoid schizophrenic. From June to August, I was in 3 psychiatric wards and 4 treatment centers, plus the critical care episode, the whole heart attack thing. I was a mess. And at Teen Challenge, oh, I just can't. There is hope for meth addicts at Teen Challenge. I learned integrity. I learned about character. I'm giving back to my community now. I'm also on a board of a nonprofit organization that's helping to reconcile communities. I'm getting involved in things in South Minneapolis. It's exciting for me. Life is just so much better, but I care so deeply that the people that are gripped by this mess get help and get clean and live longevity, you know, clean time. I never expect to be to darken the door of a treatment center again. I will not, because I am no longer an addict. I have been set free from meth, and I just thank you for your time. I thank you for your time and listening. Thank you.
Sarah, I wish you'd get excited about what you're talking about.
Actually, when you've lived in such darkness, and your life, you know, I'm in my right mind. That's exciting.
It is.
Also
it is.
In college, and what do you get in GPA?
I'm
A+.
Yeah.
Well. Praise God. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Adam DeMars. my life evolves around methamphetamines and all different sorts of drugs. I've been in 10 different inpatient treatments. None of them worked. I just went there just basically to put back on weight. The lowest point in my life from methamphetamines, I weighed 75 pounds. That's when I was 16 years old. 90% of my family uses. This is my life. All I knew how to do is get high and get by. I went to treatments just basically to put back on weight. 21-day treatment program. Smoked marijuana through the program. Just to put on weight. I've been in and out of psychiatric wards. I was in St. Peter Paxton Hall actually 3 times, because 5 out of 7 times I've been declared legally dead out of suicide attempts. They put me in Paxton Hall because the methamphetamines literally was making me go crazy. But all I knew is how to use the drug, how to make it, how to survive with it. Without it, I didn't know anything until I came to Teen Challenge. I didn't have love, I didn't have respect for myself, I didn't have love for anybody. I didn't really have a family when I grew up. When I came to Teen Challenge, I've learned so many different things. I've learned how to let go of things, how that you can be a person. And I mean, when I went into jail just before coming to Teen Challenge, I was back down to 95 pounds. If it wasn't for Teen Challenge right now, I would be dead. They have it on the side of their vans where hope is being restored. And if you don't want to believe that, you go right ahead and not believe that, but it's the truth. Because now I got love. I have a family that I can go to when I leave Teen Challenge. I have everything. Everything that I've ever ever that I could ever ask for. And I owe it to Pastor Rich Sherber here, but most of all, I owe it to Jesus Christ himself. But I owe it to Teen Challenge because without them, I wouldn't have been able to actually been able to survive. Because, I mean, I'm a little guy. Everybody always says that to me. I mean, I still get picked on it. I got a nickname at Teen Challenge. It's Slim. And, I mean, now when I hear that name, it's like, Slim. Hey, I can live with that. Yeah. That's nothing now. And, I mean, I'm going on. I put on weight since I've been at Teen Challenge. I went into Teen Challenge at 115 pounds. I've been there for a little over 2 months, and I weigh 135 pounds. Mm. That means I've put on 30 pounds in 2 months.
Yeah. Adam, how do you know you won't, when you're done with Teen Challenge, repeat, go back to?
Because I don't even think about drugs at Teen Challenge. Like, you go to your regular treatment center. Oh, yeah. What was your drug of choice? What did you use mostly? And, I mean, you continually talk about it. I mean, how is that supposed to help you? When I went to Teen Challenge, I went straight in. And when I was going up to my floor, I had a guy come in and say, "Wow, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're still alive. I'm glad you're with us. We're glad to have you here." I mean, I literally looked at the guy and said, "Well, ain't you going to ask me what kind of drugs I use? That's not important here. The importance is that you're here and that you're still alive." They don't look at, "Oh, you did this? Oh, wow, let's talk about it. Oh, hey, maybe if you do this maybe if you talk about this drug even more, maybe you won't use it." That's what I get out of the 21-day program. I mean, 21 days. I'm not even over my addiction. I'm not even close to being over it. 2 months, and I still have the craving for methamphetamines, but every time that I have the craving for them, I know that all I have to do is talk to somebody in Teen Challenge, and Teen Challenge will tell me, "Hey, we don't have to live like that no more. We don't have to think about our past. Whatever's hurting you, get that out." Because we hide behind so much that we don't know that we're hiding behind. Teen Challenge helps us find that. They dig deep.
If I may, Pastor Sherbert, thank you for making me cry every time, but that's the way it works. To both Adam and to Sarah, are you exceptions? I mean, you're telling us, I think in one case 7, another case 10, are you just sort of the rare ones? I mean, it isn't just you. You know when you're there, you see other people. Are you the exception, or is that pretty common, do you think?
We're not very rare at all. You can talk to just about any one of us. All of our lives became unmanageable. Yeah. We didn't know what we were doing. We were lost until we came to Teen Challenge. Teen Challenge helps you slowly figure out what you did wrong, where you went wrong at, and how to forgive people that you've never known that you've been able to do in your life before. And, I mean, you won't never find the hospitality like Teen Challenge has. I mean, I remember when I first walked in the door, I had him greet me. That Pastor Rich greet me, and it was just awesome.
Yeah, you're pretty exceptional. Were you exceptional in terms of having 7 cycles around, or did you see it around you?
No, actually, there's I actually did an internship where we wrote testimonies, and so I would interview some of the other students, my fellow students. It's amazing how many people have been in 10 or more. I mean, just, it's incredible. And even with my circle of friends, like before I came to Teen Challenge, we'd all been through the treatment thing. That was part of life as an addict, you know? You stop off at the treatment place, you get back, that's just kind of life. I never knew anybody, I still don't know anybody, who's been actually living successfully clean, who hasn't gone back to meth. That's when I first came to Teen Challenge, my hopes were kind of doubtful, you know, because I had never known anybody to get off of it. And then at Teen Challenge, now I know a lot of my fellow graduates who have been living clean lives, successfully going to school, going, you know, working, moms back with their kids. So it's not an exception. It is quite common, but there's hope at Teen Challenge.
Well, thank you for having the guts to come here. And to the person that gets more testimonials, I don't know, sometimes I think you should be wearing a Superman outfit or something like that, if I'm being sure. But I'm sorry, Representative Trump, do you have a question to the testifiers?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how long the average treatment is at Teen Challenge?
Sarah, you want to take a shot or which you can?
I'm sorry. I've got a little presentation. Would this help if I give you just
in case some of the committee does not know who we are? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
I want to start by saying I appreciate, I know standing behind me are treatment providers that we are pro-treatment. I'm in favor of every treatment provider that's standing behind me. We're not here to point fingers at them, and we're not here. We're pro-sobriety. We're in favor of anyone that's trying to get help and providers that are helping them. One of the
would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Rich Sherber. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Teen Challenge. Rebecca, who was our first presenter, was presented with the environmental health. There were several key words that I heard her share when she talked about going into meth homes, and they were things like sexual activity. In almost most cases where meth is going on, she talked about criminal activity. I wrote these down. Pornography. I don't know if you picked that up. She talked about neglect. She talked about filth. She talked about weapons, explosives. At Teen Challenge, our focus is not just chemical dependency, but we're looking at some living skills that we can give these people, like Adam, who's come in, who his whole family, most of my meth users, his whole family, and he can talk about it later with you. Just to give you an update of who we are, Teen Challenge has been around for 50 years. We're part of a network of over 200 teen challenges outside the U.S. border, over 170 teen challenges inside the United States, which makes it actually one of the world's largest networks of programs, rehabilitation programs helping substance abusers. It's a program that President Bush has strongly endorsed in this faith-based initiative. Locally, we work very close with a number of counties. We get adjudications on a regular basis from over 35 counties. It's a program that Amy Klobuchar has strongly endorsed, Governor Plenty has endorsed, actually his wife Mary Plenty served for years on our Teen Challenge board. Locally, we operate one of the largest residential programs helping substance abusers. We have a license for 380 Bona Lodge beds. We operate two separate programs. We have a 60-day licensed extended care program, which is licensed and supervised by the Department of Health. And then we also have a one-year living skill program. We have, I think, about 50 extended care beds that are licensed by the Department of Human Services. And then we have about 270 people that go through our year-long program. And what's unique about our program, too, we have four programs in this year-long program. We have a program for teen boys and teen girls, 14 through 17, and then adults, 18 and older. For our teens, we operate a Minneapolis public school on-site, which is a key to help. This is a contract alternative school, so we send our kids off to the public school. These are kids with discipline problems and kids with drug problems. They're going to latch on to the worst kids they can. By having the atmosphere where we have them there, Teen Challenge, with our staff supervising, we're gaining tremendous momentum. As a matter of fact, 95% of our kids are failing school when they come into Teen Challenge within 3 months. Data would show, I believe, it's close to 70% of them on the A and B honor roll. We deal with a very chronic community. You heard it. You don't come into Teen Challenge, a one-year, actually 13-month residential program, and a one-year program unless you have a very serious addiction. Over 75% of our people have been in prior treatment. So right off the bat, we've got a handicap because you're not dealing with an average marijuana user that that's got a problem smoking dope a couple times a week, or someone who's maybe got alcohol has got a little out of his hand. These are chronic addicts. What's unique about our program, too, is that our funding, basically for the year-long program, the only funding we've been able to get is what they call group residential housing for the year. And the teen program, we get no help, zero, other than they run a Minneapolis public school. The group residential housing we'll talk about a little bit, we subsidize these 300 people in our program, and an average of about 65 to 70% is non-governmental funding. So we're beating the trail all the time, trying to raise money everywhere we can. I shared with Representative Bradley and others that we're just starting a teen challenge in Duluth for 50 beds, and the ship is starting to sink. We cannot do it. Just so you get an idea, as it pertains to meth, we just recently just completed a survey of the meth addicts who had been in our program, have been out 3 years, or have been in our program 3 years or longer, graduated. We tracked, these are over 100 meth addicts. Basically, we asked the question, and this was not a very sophisticated evaluation. This was the question. Have you used meth? You've been out 6 months or longer, 6 months to when you came in 3 years, 3 years ago. Have you used meth once since you graduated Teen Challenge? And our data came back that 57% said they had not used meth once or drugs. Of that, but many of them said, we probably had 10 of them said, yeah, I've used meth one or two times, but there's a wake-up call, and man, I'm back on track now. And we said, well, that don't count. That don't count. You're a failure. You've used, of this 57%, I've got data that shows, and many of you are aware of it, that many treatment programs, if you want to see that, I can present that afterwards, are saying close to 5%, at best, 10% recovery from meth is a good norm. There's two main reasons for our success. Number one, length of stay, and that was a question that was asked earlier to the Department of Health. This is a article that was in Newsweek, Ronnie Downey Jr.'s addiction, and basically they have a whole chapter on length of program, but basically here you can see it, the strongest predictor of its success is time spent in supportive therapy. And here I'll read out of the paragraph, says in all recovery programs, the best predictor of success is length of treatment. While relapse is common, those who remain in at least a year-long program are twice as likely to stay clean, and research shows that three-quarters of those who graduate from 12-month programs are employed, drug-free, and not in jail. So I think that, number one, the length of program is a key to our success. Number two, and there's data I've got here, reports, there was actually many studies have been done over the years on Teen Challenge in its 50 years of history. I've got one that was completed. There was a graduate study that was endorsed by Northwestern University. It's a 200-page study if anybody wanted to see it. And basically this study showed that 86% of people that were surveyed, this did not include Minnesota Teen Challenge, but looked at random samplings of Teen Challenges across America. This was completed 3 years ago. 86% of people who completed Teen Challenge were drug-free 3 years or longer, which is a phenomenal success rate. The second major component, and I think these guys would say it, is that we live in a new age. I think faith is important to rehabilitation. All 12-step programs are built on a spiritual model. At Teen Challenge, we are a Christian program, and we facilitate people. People are not looking for a Christian program. We help them find the program that they're looking for. I've got data here if anyone will see it. The National Center of Addiction and Substance Abuse about a year and a half ago released this, a two or three year study was called So Help Me God. Let me just highlight the summary of this. It says the findings of this 2 year study were this: if ever the sum were greater than the parts, it's continuing and combining the power of God and religion and spirituality to prove success. And the whole thing goes on to say that faith is a key in this recovery thing. If you ask Sarah afterwards, if you come over and talk, and we invite all of you to come and look, ask our 300 residents, what is the key? Why is it working in Teen Challenge? They would say what?
The Lord.
The Lord. the Lord. And so, and we don't want to take that out of the program. That's why we've been sort of on the umbrella of the Board at Large. We can still function as a Christian program. We can have our chapel services. We can bring in guest pastors. I think the key to our program, just so you know, what's happening right now in Minnesota, I've got five counties. I can't go back to the office without some county, some sheriff's department, someone begging us, saying, we don't care, we'll do what we have to do, we'll raise the money, will you bring a teen challenge to our area? It's epidemic out there. And I just want to share this Minnesota Department of Health website. It says on the front page, I believe students say it's easier to find meth in school right now than alcohol. I got data here, and I just want to share with you two things. Remember, well, let me read this. This was a Department of Corrections memo that was sent out recently, and it says this. To those who completed inpatient chemical dependency treatment in the community of 2002, the average length of stay was 30 days, and the average cost was $11,940, almost $12,000. Then it goes on to say this. According to this is put out by Dennis Benson. He said, according to the Department of Human Services, the completion rate for community-based inpatient treatment programs was 69%. I don't know if that was a 28-day or a 60-day program, but what that said is 69% completed and 30% dropped out. Our data is identical. As a matter of fact, we're 10 points better. 77% of those who complete our 60 days, and just so you understand how this works, the same exact program we worked with Bob Orlando, who's in charge of Hennepin County Chemical Health. He's put us his stamp of approval on our program, and we run everyone through. But we have about 30 people that are in extended care at any one time. The people who are, and of that, we get a county contract with that. But of those who aren't in that extended care, we run everyone through a 60 days of treatment program. And then it's not licensed by the state, but identical programming, identical curriculum, and then from there we transition them into the Teen Challenge curriculum. I could go on and on, but I just want to share this in summary. I think that this body needs to look at the fact, number one, obviously you cannot continue to create models that are so expensive you're going to exhaust the state. There are faith-based communities and even other providers that can do this, I think, less. Just so you get an idea, we're doing in 1 month, Chairman, at three-quarters of the cost, we do for a whole year at three-quarters of the cost of $692, what the average provider here, according to the Department of Human Services, takes $12,000, we do at three-quarters of the cost, $692, can do for a whole year. And with maybe, I think, for the data out there, much greater success rates. So thank you for your attention. If we have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
I saw some questions there. Sure, but just a couple things, and maybe somebody here in the committee, I believe there's a tour that's been arranged for February 25th. Representative Sanderson, can you share that with the committee? Just to
thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I am coordinating the tour on the 25th, and I think that there's going to be a van to come over and pick us up.
Yes.
From this site. So anybody that is interested in this, I think it would be very valuable.
And Representative Sanderson, should they contact your office to make
contact my office, and we'll be leaving here at 9 o'clock.
Okay, thank you. Representative Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Here a few weeks ago, Pastor Rich was chaplain for the day, and I got to talking to him, and he invited me for a visit. I kind of knew the population that we were going to be going to see, so I didn't shave. I had on a pair of jeans and a denim jacket and a flannel shirt and walked in. I don't believe you, the people that I spoke to begin with did not know I was coming. So this wasn't a setup or anything. I can tell you and tell the committee that I don't know if I've ever been so touched by a site visit. I went amongst 300 addicts, and they looked like the population I expected to see, and I sat right in the middle of them and listened to what they were saying to each other. and how they were supportive of each other. We had men putting arms around men that looked like they were in pretty rough shape and offering very solid encouragement that they could get through this. And I will tell you that what Pastor Rich has told us today here, I found to be true. And I walked away from there thinking, yes, there is hope for these folks where, you know, we've been told in the past there really isn't much hope. This program works, and I would encourage all the members here to really go over there and visit their program. It is quite a powerful experience.
Well, I would echo that as well, and I think Pastor Rich has been responsible for bringing tears to my eyes many, many, many times. If you've ever gone to the annual dinner and you hear the testimonies and you listen to the choir and all kinds of things, it is quite a touching experience. And that's sort of the touch the heart side, which is wonderful, but which is, I think, equally important is this touches the fact side. I mean, facts are very stubborn things, and it is through the test of time. I've been watching Teen Challenge now for actually several years, and the statistics remain remarkable, absolutely remarkable. And by the way, this is one, it ain't partisan. Now Senator Scoble and I haven't seen eye to eye on a lot of issues, but I'll tell you, on this one, we have been arm in arm. There was a time not too many years ago when the program was threatened because of issues about licensing and things, and to be perfectly honest, what you said about your having to make separations because of the faith base to me is absolutely nonsense. I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that says that you don't have the right to express faith, and for us to think that we pay for secular only and we don't pay for the treatment side, you understand what they're having to do? They're having to live off the group residential housing part and then a company, and I find it sort of incredible that we haven't found a way yet to be funding the other part. If you know, we ought to pay for results. We talk about this in healthcare, and I think this is an example of paying for results. What I love is sort of the honesty. I mean, if you listen to the statistics, I don't think that Reverend Kirby is saying anything that is 100%. I mean, this is tough audiences, and so there are ones that don't make it too. And that's sort of a test. I think, it's a remarkable story. I mean, I guess I could sort of go on. I apologize to the members, maybe I a little extra enthusiasm, but it's not because of a single visitor things. I've watched Teen Challenge for a lot of years, and I've always come away impressed. Thank you for what you do, and thank you again for your wonderful testimony. That's not a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Pastor Rich, I'm wondering, do you have a waiting list of people that want to come in?
We just opened another facility in Minneapolis, actually, 3 months ago. We took over the old Stevens Square Nursing Home, so we're slowly adding beds because we subsidize every resident there over $1,000 a month, so you can only do that so much without this. But yes and no, it all depends. If there's, we remain full. I think right now we've got maybe 8 beds open for men, 7, something like that, and we watch who we get in. We're very, you know, we want the right community. If we want someone who's got a very desperate addiction, and number two is very open to a Christian program, we don't want anyone that would be offended in what we've done.
And then, follow up, please. You said something about $646 versus $11,000. I'm not sure what period of time, because now you just said that $1,000 a month is what you have to subsidize the program. So what is the total amount that it costs for?
Yep. Our cost, I've got a breakdown here exactly. It was over $1,000. It's $1,400. Our exact cost here is $2,216.48 a month for the adult program. Of those, and it's pretty close to that for the teen program. And then we get an average, because we were able to get a rate increase on some of the GRH beds, our average GRH is $757, so we're subsidizing every adult right now at $1,400 a month. So we just, I just left Teen Challenge. There were 4 people in lobby. You were talking, there were 3 people coming, doing intake, all of them, 2 of them standing with their family, just crying hysterically, saying, my son's going to die. There are no more treatment options for him. Can you help him? I said, you you tell your story to him. It'll work. And I said, get us in your churches. We need help. And so...
Thank you. Well,
I just want to say thank you for the work you do.
I think that's pretty unanimous here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening.
Well, and I do want to move on, and my apologies to the other testifiers. I was a little afraid about our time schedule, but to the extent you can, from Winston County, my good friend Tom Ryan, if you'd please come forward and give your testimony. I'm sorry. By me. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman Bradley. My name is Tom Rimey. I'm with the Dodge Fillmore Olmsted Community Corrections in Rochester, Minnesota. And I believe we have a PowerPoint that's ready to roll here. Let's go back a little bit. First of all, it's a very powerful presentation, and certainly difficult to follow that kind of emotion. I can say that some of our offenders have certainly benefited from that program, and there's nothing about what I'm going to say that's going to suggest that anything faith-based is negative in any way. What I'd like to talk to you shortly about today is about trying to adequately fund treatment out in our communities. And I'm speaking primarily about offender populations. We have developed a collaborative approach between our adult detention center in Rochester and our social services department. Chemical Health Division has contracted with a local provider, and together we've developed a meth-specific treatment program that has been running for a very short time, and I'm just here to advocate for the need for additional funding statewide for offender populations in the community. I can't get it to move forward.
Yep, there you go.
There we go. just give you some examples of why we need to focus on offenders. They clearly represent the greatest risk to public safety through violence and other crime, manufacturing of meth, the high cost of enforcement, investigation, prosecution, etc. It's right there before you on your handouts. They're least likely to be able to afford treatment. They have high failure rates in traditional treatment programs, even higher than the general population. Doesn't you've heard some statistics today? Offenders bring particular challenges to treatment, and they have not done particularly well in traditional in or outpatient treatment modalities. Much more expensive to incarcerate prisoners than it is to treat them and manage them in the community. Our local jails and correctional supervision best practices can be employed to keep people in our communities rather than give them long prison sentences, and we can do it safely and effectively. Just some examples on the next slide of why meth addiction is so costly to treat. You've heard earlier reference the Matrix Institute, certainly a leader nationally in information regarding how to effectively treat methamphetamines. They originally got their experiences with cocaine treatment, and much of the information I draw comes from there, and then there's other references at the very end of my presentation that tell you where I get the information from. One critical component with meth is an increased attention to the detoxification and stabilization process. Folks come in, whether it be to a treatment program or jail or a hospital, in terrible shape, physically, mentally. I'm sure you've heard all kinds of stuff about the dental issues, medical issues, sores on their bodies, very serious brain damage due to this chemical and all the toxic substances that go into making it. Our particular program, because our treatment starts in the jail, is able to pay attention to this because the jail has some medical staff, nursing staff, and mental health staff to assist us with that. The need for psychiatric oversight goes along with that. And again, because we start in the jail, we can do that, but funding does limit this, and it's an area that needs additional attention. Cognitive behavioral strategies are much research will show you that on offender populations, particularly, cognitive behavioral approaches are the most effective. Again, that says nothing, as I'll get to later, to say that the spiritual component is not important. It's very important as well. it's just not enough with offender populations many times. Using things like the motivational interviewing, motivational enhancements, and research-based techniques requires additional training for treatment providers, some of whom are very much on board with that, but many of whom need additional training. That costs money as well. The critical importance of additional individual and family counseling that most traditional treatment programs do not provide enough of. I think the testimonials here earlier speak volumes to the importance of family, of support, people around you. You can't do this on your own. Treatment length and intensity. I just want to echo the number one indicator of treatment success, and this does follow for offenders as well, is length of treatment. Ability to retain people in treatment. And I'll talk just a little bit more of that a little further on. The importance of frequent and random drug testing. Now, being a corrections professional, I have to say that I can be a little cynical at times, and it's not enough for me to call someone and ask them if they've been using lately. We test frequently and randomly. I think that's important, and I think it gives the treatment program a lot more validity and really is something you can sink your teeth into in terms of facts, which are indeed stubborn. The use of behavioral incentives is a critical component, again, through research. It's simple things like if you're able to have a clean UA, maybe you get a $5 certificate to go to a movie, or maybe you get a $5 gas card, or things like that. I've read a lot about it. It's very hard to find funding, of course, in a governmental agency to do this. I think the private sector is important there, but I think those incentives have been proven to be very effective in helping people with their sobriety and their recovery. And finally, an extended aftercare / relapse prevention support groups. Those support groups certainly include 12-step, AA-type groups, faith-based groups, something called SMART recovery groups, or a new cognitive behavioral-based system that is also helpful. This does indeed need to go on for up to 2 years, if not longer, including this support and aftercare. One thing that you'll find as I talk about our program is that because of the length of this program, folks can indeed move up and down in intensity and stay within the same treatment program even if they do relapse, even if they do have struggles. And I think that's very critical rather than going into 10 28-day treatment programs and spending all that money. Crossroads and Odyssey are the names of our, we have a jail-based portion, and then we have a portion that you would call outpatient, but it runs out of our work release center in Olmsted County. I think one of the strengths of this is that it's an easily replicated approach to treatment success with methamphetamine abusers. It's a collaborative effort, as I mentioned earlier, between us and corrections that provide intensive supervision, the drug testing, a variety of other things. We also provide the offenders, the jail, which is a very important component for the detoxification and stabilization piece, and our social services and local community treatment providers. We are all working together, pulling in the same direction. I've seen for all too many years offenders go in and out of treatment programs and do it independently and separately from the rest of their lives and the rest of what they're doing. It needs to be a collaborative effort. There needs to be a number of folks involved with this process.
Excuse me, Mr. Ryan, I hate to do this, but we're going to have to wrap up within just a couple minutes. There's another test, but I'd like a couple
minutes. I'm happy to do that.
Sorry about that. But
that's not a problem. I've already mentioned a bit about Crossroads. This is just the length. This really isn't all that critical. I wanted you to know this if you had the opportunity to, but it is a limited number of hours. And at the bottom, we're limited by the fact that the consolidated fund only fund so much treatment, so many hours, so many sessions in a given time period. I just moved on to the Odyssey program, which is a one-year outpatient intensive program located in the Work Release Center. Folks in that program are under direct correctional supervision by a specialized agent at all times with that drug testing, etc. Again, it's difficult to do everything we need to have the successes, which are indeed 60% and higher if best practices are followed. Early statistics, just to show you that we have our struggles, but we're having some successes. We don't take the easy ones only. We've got some very difficult clients, and we've had some that have not succeeded thus far. We have several that are, and it's very early on, as you'll see by when our program started. Some financial considerations to quickly look at. The summary of this is that treatment is much less expensive than prison. And especially when it's done right, you can have a great deal of success and keep people in the community with their families, earning money, paying taxes, paying restitution, etc. Department of Corrections has shown since 2000, we've gone from zero to over 1,000 offenders in our prison setting. That's an alarming trend. And I simply mentioned then that out of 126,000 probationers, if you look at the same percentage, we've got at least 16,000 Minnesotans out there who are at very high risk with meth addiction. Non-treated offenders, we've been four times more frequently than those who are successful with complete treatment nationally. And then some comparisons to dollars spent. Spending money on treatment saves you money in a lot of different ways. And with methamphetamine, because of all of its risks in the community and public safety, it's certainly higher than that. The main conclusion, members of the committee and Chairman Bradley, is that this legislature cannot afford not to adequately fund treatment in our communities, because I don't believe we as Minnesotans or this body can afford to build as many prison beds as it's going to take to manage this epidemic through punishment. I'm hopeful that you'll fund these best practices, that you'll help treatment providers in our communities implement these best practices to the degree that can help them be successful at the kind of levels that you see out of something like Teen Challenge. There's some resources there or sources for this information at the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
There probably would be many if we had the time. I apologize for that again, but I think you've given us references and...
My number, email is there. I'd be happy to help in any way I can. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And then, although we're right on time, I would invite Carol Falkowski just sort of for a very brief presentation. And while Ms. Falkowski is coming forward, Chair, the committee, I'd like to just announce to you, we have made members to our subdivision on licensing that's chaired by Representative Huntley. The additional members are Representative Finstead, Pepin, Emmer, Dean, Eakin, and Thiessen. They will be members of that committee. And also today, I'm referring to that committee a number of licensing scope of practice bills. That includes House File 464, House File 534, House File 556, House File 575, House File 637, House File 861, or is that the 7? 681 and House File 854. Those are all issues that we will be looking to that group to give advice back to the main committee when those come back. Well, that'll be an action by the chair. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Carol Falkowski. I'm Director of Research Communications at the Hazelden Foundation. I would like to thank Representative Bradley and all of you committee members for allowing me time to speak with you today. I come to this committee with what I consider a unique perspective on drug abuse in Minnesota. For the past 20 years, I've been one of 20 drug abuse researchers in the country who monitors drug abuse trends for the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Every 6 months, I write a report on drug abuse trends in the Twin Cities area. That report was passed around. And if you do not get a copy of that report, it's available on our website, and every 6 months, you can probably see it in the newspapers or hear me talking on public radio or CCO about it. What amazes me, and for the past 7 years I have been at the Hazelden Foundation. Prior to that I was with state government for 20 years. But throughout all of that I'm attached at the hip with monitoring drug trends in Minnesota. What amazes me in having done it for this amount of time is that every 6 months there's something new that really pops out that distinguishes drug abuse trends in the Twin Cities area. The story of the report that you received for December, the really big news in that was that for the first time ever, 9.5% of people coming into addiction treatment programs in the Twin Cities area had meth as their primary problem. This was unprecedented. And of that group, 18% of them were people under the age of 18. 18%. This has never really happened before. Both of these are unprecedented. It is this national group I'm part of that, by the way, just to backtrack, that was the first group to identify the abuse of crack cocaine, the first one to identify the drug rape drug. And as we look back and see this trend of methamphetamine, I think back to when crack first appeared, and people wondered, well, when is it going to trickle down and start hitting teenagers? And to a large extent, crack never really did. Well, with methamphetamine, we have seen within a matter of a year it trickle down and become very available at high schools. Now, this report is for the Twin Cities area, and to me what it speaks to is that methamphetamine is not exclusively a rural problem, and it is not exclusively an adult problem. Now, that said, what I am here to talk about today is addiction treatment, and I will be brief. Addiction is a chronic disease with behavioral components like asthma, diabetes, and high blood pressure. In order to get better, you have to change your behavior. Treatment for addiction is as effective as treatment for other chronic diseases. I distributed to you an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association that compares the outcomes of addiction treatment to those of other chronic disorders. Multiple episodes of treatment are typical, regardless of the drug of choice. Addiction is a disorder that requires periodic professional services and is something that requires lifelong management. Now, can methamphetamine addiction be successfully treated? Absolutely. Yet, too often we hear treatment for meth addicts doesn't work. I'm sure you've all heard that. I've been to forums around the state. I've heard elected officials say that. I've heard law enforcement say that. For those of us in the addiction field, it is sadly reminiscent of what people said about crack addicts in the 1980s and alcoholics during Prohibition. It is simply not the case. Consider the primary research-based principles of addiction treatment according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And for that, I'd like to direct your attention to my other handout that was something I was asked to write after I spoke at a national conference and was on a panel about meth treatment with Scott Burns at the White House Drug Policy Office. First, what the principles of addiction treatment find, based on 20 years of research on treatment, find that no single type of treatment is effective for all people. That's why we have a mix in this state as well as nationally of programs like Teen Challenge, programs like Hazelden, hospital-based programs, a mix of programs. It also finds a principle of treatment is that it needs to be readily accessible for those who need it. Yet by some estimates in this country, up to two-thirds of those who need addiction treatment do not receive it. Research also finds that remaining in treatment for an adequate period of time is critical for treatment effectiveness, and that longer treatment exposure enhances the likelihood of sustained sobriety. Here, it is really key to understand that it is longer treatment exposure that does it, not necessarily inpatient or outpatient, but longer treatment exposure. I'll get back to that. In reality, however, there are often caps or restrictions on both the length and type of addiction treatment benefits, even for those with health insurance. For public pay clients, especially in non-urban areas, the options are more limited. And with meth addicts in particular, this adequate duration of treatment is needed to sort out the conditions. What are psychiatric conditions that were pre-existing, and what were the result of the meth addiction? Further, the research shows that short periods of abstinence, like detox or spending time in jail, in the absence of treatment, do little to change behavior and support recovery in the long haul. Jail is not the same as treatment. Therefore, no one should be surprised when an addict who has not received treatment continues to use when he's out on pretrial release or after getting released from jail or prison if he didn't receive treatment. Without treatment, the addiction progresses. Finally, the treatment approach is similar regardless of the primary drug. So we need to provide treatment to folks. As you look at how to address this issue, we need to provide it within our correctional facilities as well as our communities. If you're talking about field trips, I would invite you to go down to the program about the gentleman who just testified, and also the Challenge Incarceration Program. That's a program operated by the Department of Corrections. It's 6 months of boot camp followed by a year of supervised living in facilities. And I have talked to a number of people who have been through that program, and they said they were serving time and just thought, I'll just get out, I'll get my things back, no problem. They were just waiting to get out and use and make meth again. And it wasn't until they got treatment that they turned their lives around and really got the tools they needed to live a different life. Within communities, we have both 12-step programs, and the Matrix model of treatment is a nationally recognized outpatient model of addiction treatment that has wonderful success for meth addiction. I think a more accurate assessment rather than treatment doesn't work for meth addicts is that it is not as accessible as it should be, especially for meth addicts, most of whom have lost their jobs, their assets, their homes, their families, and their health. With meth addicts in particular, an adequate length of treatment is necessary in order to determine which psychiatric disorders, again, are pre-existing and which are due to the meth. Equally unavailable are sober transitional housing units after treatment, and this, again, is a critical component of treatment. So, as for the notion of holding treatment programs accountable by having the legislative auditor compare outcomes across programs, that's something that is part of some of these bills you're looking at. I ask you to stop and ask yourself whether you would do that for any other disease. Would you even consider withholding MinCare or Medicaid payments to healthcare providers whose patients do not comply with asthma treatment or have a second heart attack because they don't change their diet or they do not take their insulin? Of course not. And even if treating addiction were as simple as a surgical procedure for cancer, wouldn't you expect different outcomes depending on when the cancer was caught? Of course you would. Patients diagnosed earlier in the progression of the disease would tend to have more favorable prognosis.
Excuse me, Ms. Pelsa. Yes. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. We'll be under time, so
yep.
Please.
I have four sentences left. In disease management, there's variability in outcome that has little to do with treatment and everything to do with patients, and so too with addiction treatment. So as you stand poised to address meth, this business-as-usual attitude I do not believe will serve us well. I don't believe we can simply solve this problem at the corner pharmacy by restricting precursor chemicals, and we cannot arrest our way and incarcerate our way out of this problem without also providing resources to arrest the addiction that underlies it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I know we're well over, so I think there'll be no further business. We're adjourned.